I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome back to Radio Times. Benjamin Franklin and Thomas Jefferson are known for many things, including their passion for science and technology. Science and technology play a vital role in all of our lives today, including in diplomacy and international affairs. Energy Secretary Ernest Moniz sat at the negotiation table dealing with his counterpart on the nuclear deal with Iran. Earlier this year, medical experts from all over the world went to Western Africa to stop the spread of Ebola and care for patients sick from the virus. Last week, the U.S. opened its embassy in Havana, but before that, Cuban and American scientists were working together on shared interests involving water. Today in Radio Times, science diplomacy, using science to build bridges with other countries and to tackle some of the globe's most challenging problems. And we have three guests who have joined us in this hour of Radio Times. And joining us from the NPR studios in Washington, D.C. is Rush Holt. He's a physicist, currently the chief executive officer for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. He served 8 terms in Congress, Democratic representative from New Jersey's 12th Congressional District. And Rush Holt, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times, wearing a very different hat today.
Well, Marty, it's great to be with you again. Thank you.
You're very welcome. Also with us is Vaughn Tarikian. He's Chief International Officer at the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS, Director of the Center for Science Diplomacy, Editor-in-Chief of Science and Diplomacy, and he's here with us in our Philadelphia studio. And Vaughn, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. It's great to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And our third guest is Audra Wolfe. She's a writer, editor, historian based here in Philadelphia, wrote a book called Competing with the Soviets. It's about the role of science in the Cold War, working now on a book on the history of science diplomacy, which is why you're here, Audra Wolfe. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thanks so much for having me.
You're very welcome. Rush Holt, let me begin with you, and I hate to do this because it sounds like such a wonky way to begin our conversation, but I want to make sure our listeners know what is meant by science diplomacy. And I'll be honest, until a couple of weeks ago, I hadn't really put those two words together. How do you define it?
Well, in a real sense, they have been – the concepts have been together for a long, long time. But it as a field of study, as a topic for discussion, it's relatively recent. And this journal that you mentioned that Vaughn Tarikian edits, Science and Diplomacy, is helping to advance the field. And Audra Wolfe is as well with her writings. It's based on the idea that both the way science works and – the way science works can advance political ends. And, you know, it's based on the idea that science is built on broad and open communications. Mm-hmm. It depends on the free flow of ideas, and evidence-based thinking is central to it. Those things have a democratizing and civilizing effect. And so science can actually advance diplomacy and improve political and diplomatic relations. The other way around, the diplomacy for science through international agreements and international engagement, one can advance the practice of science and extend the benefits of science to people more fairly and more generally.
And I do want to pick up on all of that. Vaughn, let me give you a chance to weigh in on this as well. And you really have a personal story that I think explains what Rush Holt was talking about.
I do. And I appreciate this this opportunity, because I think one of the interesting things about science diplomacy is that it's both very large scale, but it's also very personal. And so the story you mentioned, Marty, is that about 2.5 years ago, my son, Chip, Charles, was born with a pretty severe congenital heart defect, where he had his two major arteries were switched, his aorta and his pulmonary artery. The result was that he was a blue baby. He was not getting the proper oxygen to his cells, and therefore born he was blue. But one of the great advantages he had, and many children in the United States, and of course being here in Philadelphia with the Children's Hospital, which is one of the most famous, many people know about it in this region as well, is that he had access to some of the best medical care and some of the best medical research that had been done around this issue. But it was not just medical research and medical personnel from the United States or within the United States. It was actually a global effort where the identification of this condition, the solutions to this condition were actually global. They were things that were discovered as far away as Brazil and in the UK many years ago. But But his surgery team, his nursing team, everybody and that cared for him throughout the process were representatives of the global science community, many of them attracted to the United States because of its great research capacity and its investment in things like health research. And so he was a beneficiary of that.
Obviously underscoring the fact that we live in this very globalized but very interconnected world. So you could have a doctor that was born in another country, trained in another country, doing surgery on a child in this country, for instance.
Absolutely. And his surgeon, actually, Dr. Jonas, was somebody who not only was from Australia coming to the United States, but in fact is very active in now working with other children in developing countries that have congenital heart defects, including in Afghanistan. And so he's worked very closely to try to promote the role of science and its applications to making, honestly, children's lives better. And I think that's a valuable and important part of what science diplomacy is about.
Absolutely. And to you, Audra, your first book was really about the Cold War. Are we talking about something dramatically different today when you compare the kind of science diplomacy we're talking about today and looking back at the Cold War?
Well, there's a lot of similar strands, and I think Rushholt's definition of science diplomacy captures most of what's happening in both of those eras. But one of the ways that science diplomacy was a bit different in the 50s and 60s, which was really the last time that the United States really made a significant push for science diplomacy, was this idea of science as a way of life, or science as part of the American way of life. Rushholt alluded to this a little bit about that encouraging systems of openness, fostering democratic systems, that science can be a part of that. But during the Cold War, there was really this idea that there was a Western way of doing science and there was a Soviet way of doing science, and that part of the Hearts and Minds campaign absolutely involved promoting the benefits of the American approach to science as opposed to the Soviet approach to science. So in that respect, science was actually part of cultural diplomacy in the same way, similar to, say, orchestral tours or art exhibits, that information about science could actually be part of that.
Well, I'm thinking about this. I'm old enough to remember the space race of the 1950s when the U.S. Essentially taking on the Soviet Union at the time.
Absolutely. And the space race is really a pretty good example of similarities because most space technologies are actually dual-use technologies. You know, the kinds of rockets that you use to launch space capsules are often missiles. So on the one hand, the American space program was very much about openness and projecting a vision of openness to the rest of the world. But it couldn't be entirely open because of some of the technologies used throughout the system. And there's certainly commonalities there when we think about nuclear research or certain other kinds of kind of high security research.
Rushholt, let me go back to you. And I'm thinking about the problems, the challenges that the world faces, everything from climate change to food security, overpopulation. You know, I could go on and on with a long list of frankly, very pressing needs. Is that where you think science diplomacy can make a difference? Because I'm not sure you can send in the military to deal with food insecurity or climate change or even overpopulation.
It can make a difference in lots of ways and has. Science is really special. It's not just another subject in school. And our association, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, which is the world's largest membership general interest scientific organization, 100,000 members, 250 member societies and so forth, was formed 165 years ago by some far-sighted scientists who thought it was important not to promote just geology or botany, but the very idea of science for the advancement of science to benefit society, humans, worldwide. And so it's partly, as Audre Wolfe was saying, a way of thinking that helps open up society, but it's also a very productive way of thinking that leads to benefits, improved quality of life, and through appropriate international agreements and working, you can make those benefits more generally and fairly available. She talked about the Soviet Union.
Sure.
And there's an example, I think, of Evgeny Velikov, who was an advisor to Gorbachev, a very close advisor to Gorbachev. He had worked on international collaboration for decades and saw the benefits of open communication and saw the future really was this kind of egalitarian science. I mean, science is egalitarian. You know, it's the evidence that counts, not what the authorities say. You know, that we physicists like to say, you always have to remember that a lowly patent clerk in Switzerland can overturn what the authorities say. I'm referring to Einstein, of course.
Yes, of course.
But this kind of evidence-based thinking had a real effect on Velikov, who in turn had a real effect on Gorbachev. I think Audra can maybe correct me on this, but I think a very strong case can be made that that international scientific collaboration helped lead to the glasnost and perestroika, the ultimate opening up of the society and the fall of the Soviet Union. We see that to some extent in Cuba, where international scientific and medical exchanges laid the groundwork for what is now a political opening. In the Iran arms control nuclear agreement that has, you know, is under debate right now, there are specific provisions for international scientific collaboration. I hope, and I think that we shouldn't approve the agreement just on this basis, but I do hope that these features of the agreement will lead to a more cooperative behavior between Iran and the other countries, and ultimate improvement in the politics and the diplomacy.
I do want to pick up on something, and actually I know you wanted to respond to the Cold War thing, Audra, but hold on to that thought. I'm wondering to you, though, Vaughn, in about a minute or so before we have to take our first break here, and I'm thinking about, you know, the AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, but the kind of disconnect that we have, particularly in this country, but it's probably true in other countries as well, about the sort of level of science illiteracy. I mean, there are many people in this country that don't believe in evolution, for instance, or continue to doubt climate change. There is a kind of a disconnect between what you all do and I think what a lot of other people think about and do.
That's true, and thank you. And I think in terms of the understanding, sort of the pulse of the politics or the policies around science, obviously, Rush is probably as expert as anybody, both in his current position and his, I think, lifelong interest in this. One of the things that is interesting, though, is that the science cooperation and science interactions do allow you to focus on those areas where there are mutual interests and mutual benefits. And I think that's always been something that has provided a real entree for science and scientists to work with their counterparts, that you are working. You mentioned issues around climate change and food security. You're working on things that are actually of interest to both sides. And that allows for a collaborative piece. It doesn't always mean that it's not combative, but can be collaborative.
Well, let's take a very short break and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about science diplomacy. The voice you just heard is Vaughn Tarikian, and also with us Audra Wolf and Rush Holt, a name familiar here in the Delaware Valley, served in the U.S. Congress for 8 terms and now heads up the American Association for the Advancement of Science. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about science diplomacy, using science to build bridges with other nations and to tackle some of the globe's most challenging problems. Our guests are Rush Holt. He's a physicist, former congressman, now CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Vaughn Tarikian, chief international officer at AAAS, also director of the Center for Science Diplomacy. And Audra Wolf. She's a writer, historian who is writing a book on the history of science diplomacy. And to join our conversation, that phone number is 1-888-477-9499. 1-888-477-WHYY. Audra, as you shift your focus from the Cold War to today, do you see some of these common areas being things like the effects of climate change, nutrition, food security? Is that where you think there can be some global cooperation?
Absolutely, and economically too.
Right.
But climate change is a particularly interesting example because it shows one of the ways that the politics of science diplomacy has changed. That at this point, some of the audience for the messages of science diplomacy about science being open and objective is really aimed as much at Americans as it is to the international arena, you know, because you have some debates about scientific authority and scientific objectivity, maybe from the left about vaccines and autism, or from the right about climate questions about the origins of climate change. So that is a different context. It's no longer a given in the United States that the word of scientist should be something that should be taken seriously.
And do scientists know how to deal with that? I mean, that's a challenge. You mentioned some of the challenges right there.
It is an enormous challenge, and I think this is a debatable question, but personally it seems to me that part of what's happening is that scientists have almost internalized the idea that science is naturally objective and that science depends on freedom kind of as a natural state of affairs. And that's something that requires work. It doesn't mean that it's not desirable, but it's not necessarily a naturally occurring phenomenon. And that's something that, you know, scientists are coming around to figuring out how to make that case.
Well, it's a real challenge for us, Marty, the AAAS, because people look to us to not just defend science, but to be the force for science. And so when in recent years and the appreciation of science seems to be eroding, you know, whether it's climate change or vaccination or evolution teaching or any number of things that really, I think, get at the heart of what science is about and how it works. We have a real challenge in front of us to restore the traditional scientific approach of Americans. Americans have been, you know, from the days of the founders, a country based on evidence and practical thinking. And, you know, in a real sense, Americans have traditionally thought like scientists. We have to restore that. And I guess it falls to us, the AAAS, to take the lead on that. I did want to make a couple of quick points.
Sure. It's,
you know, for international scientific cooperation, it's not just climate change. I mean, in a lot of trouble countries where there are troubled relations, the United States and Burma, there are things on biodiversity that we can collaborate on. Cuba, certainly infectious diseases and oceanography and fishing. In North Korea, we right now are doing some collaboration in volcano studies, seismology. So there are some specific things to work on, as well as kind of the more general idea of the freedom to practice science.
Well, to you, Vaughn, and then I do want to get back to you, Rush Holt, because, I mean, we're talking about the use of science to make arguments about how the world can cooperate, but then you run up against human nature, which isn't always as data-driven as scientists are. How do we reconcile that?
The amazing thing is watching actually early career scientists around these issues. And you know, we've started something called it's a hashtag on Twitter, hashtag I am a science diplomat. And I will tell you some of the stories that come in from the early career scientists who are working across boundaries on some of the tricky issues, on things that really get them collaborating with each other and sharing these great stories about how they are trying to work not only to solve the problem, but also to build connections and relationships to far-flung places. And it's just a remarkable story. And not all of them are focused on the things that maybe we think are the science diplomacy-based. A lot of them are things that are at the scale of trying to find how to work together on building some sort of innovative way to solve an agricultural problem in West Africa. And watching and seeing these things come across is really interesting because you see fundamentally, science diplomacy is about the people working together to solve a problem across boundaries.
Even if their training might be very different. Yeah, I mean, there are countries where there's no electricity or running water, but they can still participate.
They still work together in science because fundamentally they have something that makes collaboration possible, which is really good brains and a lot of interest and curiosity.
And you're nodding your head, Audra. Yes.
Yes. Yes.
Let me go back to you, Rush Holt, because I know you and a number of other scientists signed a letter in support of the nuclear deal with Iran, describing it as innovative and stringent, you know, other adjectives that you use together. I used to describe it. We know, for instance, yesterday, Senator Menendez from your state, New Jersey, is opposing this. And it's interesting to see how physicists and scientists view this deal and how political people. You spent, 16 years in Congress. You know about this world, how political people can view the same document.
Well, so often in these documents, the science and technology are overlooked because so many ordinary folks, and really, I don't mean ordinary, I mean non-scientists.
The rest of us, yes.
Feel uncomfortable with science. There were a number of retired diplomats who wrote a letter to the president extolling this new agreement. There's a letter from flag officers, retired admirals and generals, who have endorsed this agreement. Not to mention some leaders from Israeli, like the former head of Mossad. But we scientists who have worked over the years on nuclear nonproliferation know the technologies and the science of enrichment, of plutonium production, and so forth. We thought it was important for us to look at this agreement and then speak to its technical components. Mm-hmm. And we came to the conclusion that the technical foundations of this are solid. That it's an innovative agreement with respect to the technologies of uranium enrichment or plutonium production, and it really blocks the paths, the identifiable paths by which Iran might go to a nuclear weapon. It blocks the possible paths, and this, I thought, we felt that we really needed to mention, it advances nuclear nonproliferation in general, because it has some innovative and stringent provisions that should be part of the IAEA and nonproliferation agreements for all nations. It's useful in that way too.
Right.
The summary is that it. It prevents Iran from getting nuclear weapons and provides strong verification that can assure us that those paths are blocked for a long period of time. Not forever. No agreement can. Actually, no war or military attack can forever prevent a country from developing nuclear weapons. Iran was within weeks to few months of having the wherewithal to build a weapon. If they had made a concerted push any time in the last couple of years, they could have done it. For some reason, maybe it was military threat or other things or internal aversion to it, whatever, they didn't do it. Now, what this agreement does is provide a long period of time of strong assurance that they won't be doing it, that it is checked.
Sure. And let me just jump in here because I know Audra Wolf wants to add something to what you're saying. And that all sounds very rational, very technical and science-based.
Absolutely. And there's a long history of American scientists, particularly American physicists, who are involved in American defense policy and weapons policy and negotiations. It does raise the issue of what the role of expertise is in a democracy, because some of these are technical issues that require technical solutions, and sometimes these are political issues. A classic example was before the atomic bomb was used, many of the scientists involved with the Manhattan Project actually issued a report advising against the use of the bomb, saying that it should be used as a demonstration. And later during questions about the nonproliferation, not necessarily nonproliferation treaties, but test ban treaties, during the test ban treaty debates of the late 1950s and early 60s, American scientists and international scientists were very involved in debates about this. But there was also a question of to what extent are these actually political questions and to what are these technical questions? There's absolutely a role in science. There's absolutely a role for scientists in this. And you cannot make good policy without good information. But there is a separate question as to whether scientists, as scientists, should, by definition, have a special role in those decisions.
What do you think about that, Vaughn?
Scientists are people, too. So I think there's a, there's an element that I think everybody has probably has an opinion. And I think, Audra, what you mentioned is really important, which is any kind of agreement, it is that has a technical basis, and more of them do. We just see more and more of them do around these the big issues, because we are seeing that issues are international and more of those international issues are underpinned by science and its applications, that it's therefore critical that the necessary but not necessarily sufficient piece of it is that the science and the technological basis of it are sound. If it isn't, you can just throw it out. If it is, then you can get to the next step.
But are you also saying, Audra, that there is more suspicion of experts and expertise today? I mean, you can Google something and feel like you're an expert, but that can take you down, you know, a bit of a rabbit hole. It can.
I do think that there is more suspicion about expertise. People have many different explanations for why this phenomenon has come to be. I think that the end of the Cold War is really important in terms of not having a foil. Because of how science was conducted in the Soviet Union, it was really important for Americans to be able to say, in the United States, science is open, science is free, science is objective. This is one of the things that makes us Americans and one of the things that makes us not like scientists in the Soviet Union. And that foil is absent. There are very few countries these days who would openly admit that they don't like the idea of open and objective science. So it seems less fraught and less like something that has to be defended, which doesn't mean that it doesn't need to be defended.
I mean, are you saying we need an enemy who is as sophisticated as we are to keep us focused on science and technology?
I'm not sure that we need an enemy, but I would say that enemies are useful in defining oneself. They always have been, for better or for worse.
And it would be a good idea, Marty, if we had a better education system so that for all Americans, science was better integrated into our education and our thinking and our civics. And until that golden age, scientists will have to speak out where they have specific expertise and where the general public and others avoid those subjects. A lot of people say to me, well, I can't understand the verification techniques of an arms control agreement, or I don't understand what's the difference between one kind of centrifuge and another kind of centrifuge. Actually, they could. But they choose not to. Most Americans, say, oh, I can't do science. I'm not a scientist. We have to work on that. I mean, our organization, the AAAS, spends a lot of time on science and society and making sure that science is well integrated into public policy. And we work on science and law and human rights, as well as international science that you're hearing about from Vaughn. In a way, it would be nice if you didn't need a special organization to do that, if everybody really integrated evidence-based thinking into all aspects of their economy and their politics.
Wouldn't that be nice?
But they don't.
No,
they
I mean, don't. Because we are, I mean, we're human beings and we have a rational side, and we, I think, also have an irrational side as well. I wonder to you, Vaughn, about, I mean, do we have the kind of science diplomats, I guess? I mean, in certain ways, that's what you're talking about, people who can operate in this world and have the kind of expertise.
Yeah, and it's interesting because we're seeing that we're getting them from both sides. A lot more scientists are interested in how what their work is affects not only the world but also affects relationships. I also am an adjunct professor at Georgetown in their School of Foreign Service. And one of the interesting things I was mentioning to Audra earlier is more and more of the students that take my class are going into places like tech companies and pharmaceutical companies and startups. They are realizing that they are not only going to be working on the international stage, but on very science and technology-driven issues, and therefore are becoming, in themselves, more interested in taking classes and learning about technology and science as it relates to not only foreign policy, but the whole broad range of international relations.
I think it's interesting, and Havana or Cuba is such a present example. We raised the flag last week over the U.S. Embassy in Havana. I'm looking at you, Vaughn, but as you all have been saying, there were many more contacts before that, or many contacts before that, on related issues between Cuban and American scientists. Do you think that laid the groundwork for what happened?
I think it provided one important strand of a relationship, and it maintained a connection even when other things were not going on. And again, it gets back to the fact that scientists were able to identify the things that were of mutual interest: fisheries, understanding atmospheric conditions. I mean, this region is well aware of the impacts of a big storm like Sandy or Katrina. These are storms that actually tend to pass in the waters or in the area of Cuba. Collaboration in those areas is actually not only beneficial to sort of scientific parts, but actually does have real impact. And there are lots of those areas where that kind of relationship was important in maintaining some connection.
Audra, should we think of science diplomacy as a form of soft power as it has been described?
Absolutely. And Cuba is a very interesting example because it doesn't involve science, but we can see a recent example of trying to use soft power, which was when USAID attempted something called Cuban Twitter. So we have seen there's a long history of soft power in Latin America and even in Europe and in Asia. And science was part of that, the idea that you could make people more sympathetic, friendlier to the United States, mm-hmm. build relationships, particularly with elites, through science, through relationships, through networks, through getting to know one another, to make the United States an attractive alternative.
So, go ahead.
One of my favorite stories was the first time I went to Cuba, which is about 6 years ago in 2009. And we were down there, and not a lot of Americans go down, and definitely not a lot of the government people. But there was a lower level group of technical people from the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, who were there meeting their counterparts in Cuba to learn about some of the technical things about weather forecasting and operations. We were at the same hotel as them. We asked, what are you doing? They said, that's what they're doing. Yeah. We got on the airplane out. And as we were flying out, you take a charter plane. You go up and down. I mean, it's a very close flight. And as our flight was taking off, the pilot got on the plane and said to the FAA folks were in the back, to the air traffic controllers from Miami, your colleagues from Cuban Air Traffic Control wanted me to say to you that they enjoyed your visit here, and they can't wait to see you back in Miami to teach you how to salsa. And it was just this moment of just existentialism where you were just in this space in between the two countries, but it was a technical cooperation that was going to be beneficial to both sides.
Let's take another short break, and we'll get back to our conversation talking about science diplomacy in this hour of Radio Times. We have emails coming in, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times, and you can call us to join the conversation, 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We're talking about science diplomacy, talking with Rush Holt. He's a physicist, a former Democratic representative from New Jersey, served 8 terms in Congress, and now the CEO of the American Association for the Advancement of Science, AAAS. Also with us is Vaughn Tarikian, Chief International Officer at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. And also with us here in our Philadelphia studio is Audra Wolf. She's a writer, editor, historian based here in Philadelphia, wrote a book called Competing with the Soviets and writing a book on the history of science diplomacy. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Rush Holt, we have an email from Pat. She says, please have Rush Holt talk about what FIRST is, F-I-R-S-T, and the huge impact it's having on science diplomacy, innovative problem solving, and raising the level and access to STEM education for all, but especially did it at let me just leave it at that. I don't quite understand how that email ends, but can you talk about that first?
I think she's talking about this high school level robotics competition where students learn not so much the integrated circuits and the mechanical engineering of robots, but operate in teams to build and operate these game-playing robots. And it's now gone international, and kids love it. And I guess the part of it that I like best is it's not just for geeks. It's not for the kids who are going to be building engineering projects anyway. It's for a lot of other kids who get a familiarity with the engineering, but mostly they're there because of team play. And I think it is an interesting non-curricular, extracurricular approach to education. And I don't know how international it's. I do know there are international teams taking part now. I don't know what sort of international effect it's having so far.
Well, it is interesting. I guess I'm looking at you, Audra, in that, children are natural scientists, and yet somehow we we take that away from them or somehow take it out of them as we educate them.
Right. And education, both in terms of what you teach kids about science, what you teach them in science, but what you teach them about science has mattered. And at least in the past, some of the things that the United States did in terms of science diplomacy involved trying to convince other countries to use American science textbooks because they would present certain ideas about the scientific method or the ways that experiments should go or the ways that scientists should be treated in society.
But I'm also thinking, I mean, there are plenty of examples of science that's been used for evil or ill. I mean, think of the science technology of the Holocaust or, you know, other bombs and things that have been obviously developed out of our technology. So it's not like science is all good.
You know, and Marty, it's not just the malicious. It's not this is Rush. Yeah, it's not just the malicious use of science. It is kind of the mistaken use of science. The Soviet misunderstanding and misapplication of evolution set back their agriculture immeasurably. And it's a reminder to us that you don't have to have a malicious, oppressive regime to interfere with the progress of human civilization. Mm. If you teach evolution wrong, or as is the case in most schools in America today, you fail to teach evolution, you miss the central organizing principle of biology, and that makes it really hard in medicine, in agriculture, in environmental protection.
Sure.
So, that's a case from the Soviet Union, the Lysenko idea, this, Lamarckian evolution and so forth.
Audrey, you want to add something?
Yeah. The case of Lysenko is very interesting. I think probably we shouldn't go into that. Okay. Well, so Trofim Lysenko was a Soviet agronomist who believed that you could increase wheat production by exposing wheat seeds to cold and that it could be reproduced through future generations. And most Western scientists said that this was a version of the inheritance of acquired characteristics, which had mostly been dismissed by that idea. In the Soviet Union, it was an attractive idea because it showed that scientists were working for the common good, that they were attempting to solve a problem. And part of why that message was so powerful was that the American researchers who were researching geneticists were working on fruit flies. So it looked very abstract. It looked like something that couldn't necessarily help people. And so as a propaganda point, it was effective from the Soviet Union's perspective, even though in the end that approach to wheat production didn't help much. I do think it's important to give these examples of failures, but I also think it's important to give examples of failures that don't involve ideology, right? So it's not just that we think about wheat production because it's going to help the peasantry. It's that scientists sometimes take wrong paths or that scientific knowledge changes. That's a really important idea about the nature of science, that when we don't say that, it really discredits science because findings inevitably change and then the public is confused. Why has this changed? Mm. So it's important to give different kinds of examples and not just the ones that are at the extremes, like Lysenkoism.
Let me read an email from Margaret. She says, in January this year, I saw or learned about the cooperation of many years duration in Antarctica. 13 nations cooperated there under treaties that have worked cooperatively so far with high hopes and expectations for continuing cooperation in our planet's future. And to you, Vaughn, I mean, there are space, I think, is an example. The Antarctic, the oceans, these are places where there is some scientific global cooperation.
Oh, there are many examples. Transboundary, across boundaries, and people work together even in some of the most difficult places on shared waterways. I mean, the Israelis and the Jordanians have worked for years to try to work on the Jordan River and making sure that the water is being monitored based on evidence-based in one of the more tricky areas. There are so many examples, as you mentioned, Antarctica, but even today, the Arctic Council. Mm. The Arctic is an area where, you know, Russians and Americans and Norwegians and all those that share that common space are working together.
Well, but not quite as much, Vaughn, I would say not quite as much. In Antarctica, it is an ironclad treaty for cooperation to advance science. In the Arctic, not so much. And there's a lot more open competition and a minor conflict. And I also, let me get a plug in here, if I may. AAAS, we publish Science Magazine and do all these other things that I referred to. We also have a terrific annual meeting. And this upcoming annual meeting, which will be held in Washington next February, has the theme specifically of global scientific engagement. And we'll be talking about this subject, these subjects, a lot.
Let me get, looks like Jeff from Wynwood to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Jeff. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Yeah. I just want to make the comment that's related directly to what one of your scientists said earlier. I mean, I'm all for science. I believe in evolution. But the problem with science is it's based on reason. And as Adorno and Horkheimer so clearly noted in their book, Dialectic of Enlightenment, reason has no agenda. And the problem is that the use of reason in science, and I want to go back to American examples now, has been influenced by ideology like crazy and in horrible ways. For example, Big Pharma making drugs that, you know, you watch the commercials, watch out, might cause, irreducible, liver damage.
Well,
or whatever.
Jeff, I don't want to get too far, because we're talking about science diplomacy here. You're saying that...
This has to do with, let's go to nuclear weapons. We are presently making even better nuclear weapons. Now, in terms of diplomacy, that's not exactly what I would call a positive diplomatic move. Or we're the only ones who haven't signed the landmine treaty.
Okay, well, let me take the nuclear weapons and we'll put it to our physicist guest, Rush Holt. What do you say back to Jeff?
Well, none of what we've said today takes away the obligation of humans to apply good ethics, to defend human rights, to advocate for the equal distribution of the benefits. And so I actually agree with him that we have had a misguided policy for decades in the United States not to take the lead toward actual nuclear disarmament. I think that almost all retired generals and admirals will tell you that they find nuclear weapons militarily useless. Mm. Once they're out of uniform, they say that. So, of course, there are lots of examples where we've allowed our economic interests to submerge humane interests. And we have to advocate that all of us have ethical responsibilities. And scientists, particularly when they're wielding powerful techniques and technologies, they have an even greater obligation to do that ethically. We at AAAS, we try to have open dialogue on these things to help advance human rights. But obviously, it's not a perfect world.
No, it isn't. And let me get Devon in on the conversation.
Yeah. Well, I would say that the building a little bit on that is one of the great areas of conversation and interaction when you're dealing in science diplomacy is around things like the conduct of science and ethics and these things that are actually in many ways the modalities of science. And we find that, particularly with developing countries that are very interested in developing their science infrastructures, oftentimes those conversations around how do we think about the science enterprise are really valuable and valued on both sides, because you begin to understand the different ways in which, maybe to get to what Audra was even talking about, the perception of how science is done or what is plagiarism versus what is not plagiarism, very fundamental things. And it's a great place for international cooperation because it affects the broader science mm-hmm. enterprise into the future.
You had mentioned Hurricane Sandy, and anyone living on the East Coast or large swaths of the East Coast know the impact of that. Storms know no boundaries. They don't have any allegiances to one country over another. And yet we are being affected by, sounds like, or feels like, bigger and bigger storms. Is this something that the world can agree on?
I think what you're seeing more and more of is that the scientists are being called in because you're seeing lots of things like natural disasters and not natural disasters. And so look at the issue around Fukushima. You had, this issue of an earthquake spawning a fairly significant tsunami, but then also had knock-on effects. Colleagues of ours in the UK talked about that as being a very valuable time for British scientists and science policy people to work with their counterparts in Japan, not only because it was solving a problem, but it actually helped build a close relationship around certain other issues as well.
I mean, Audra, out of a crisis, it brings people together.
Absolutely. But just to jump on something that Vaughn just said, referring to British-Japanese relationships, you know, the United States isn't the only country that's interested in science diplomacy right now. And particularly in Europe and in Asia, many, many nations are pursuing this. And in some ways, the United States is following instead of leading here. I think that's starting to change in the past couple of years. But it's such an exciting opportunity, and there are so many problems that cross national borders. It's a global phenomenon, and it's a wonderful development to see so many nations trying to figure out how to really make use of scientific and technical knowledge in solving those problems.
And working
Japan, Canada. Yeah, Japan, Canada, New Zealand, Australia. Japan just came out with a really great statement about integrating science into their foreign policy. The National Academy of Sciences here has come out with a report about what we can do better in the United States. And Vaughn, you know, here with us today, knows very well, you know, what the science advisor in our State Department does.
Well, and there is a science advisor. I think people might be surprised to know that the president has a science advisor.
Well, the president has a science advisor, but as Rush mentioned, the Secretary of State has a science advisor. And that was a big movement because you started in 2000. And that science advisor position has grown over the years to being something that is not political, and it allows for hopefully not only the individual but also building the infrastructure of science through things like AAAS policy fellowships and others to bring scientists into a foreign ministry, which is a major change even in the last, you know, two decades.
I was reading,
and we didn't say explicitly, you know, the agency, the USAID, the Agency for International Development, has really worked hard in the last few years to incorporate science into their work because it's based on an understanding that is growing that the best international development that we could give is capacity building. In other words, building the capacity to do science in that country.
Go ahead, Audra.
So this isn't the first time that the United States has tried to do this, and it's wonderful to see these developments. I think it's also very useful to have some historical perspective. As early as 1950, the State Department issued a fairly important report called Science and Foreign Relations that attempted to establish a science advisor in the State Department, science attachés, with the idea that the CIA should also have science attachés. And that idea has come and gone throughout. It's sort of come and gone in waves. It was extremely popular in the tail end of the Eisenhower administration up through the Kennedy administration. The Johnson administration was interested less in it, and a lot of that sort of fell apart in the late 1960s as more scientists opposed Vietnam. They were less interested in helping the United States develop and implement its foreign policy because they opposed many of the foreign policies. So they weren't many members of the scientific community were not inclined to help. So it is something that we've seen before. As a historian, I find it fascinating how much of the current language could have been lifted from some of those reports in 1950 or 1960. Then, as now, it's an idea with terrific potential. Doing it in an open and transparent way is really key to making it successful.
Well, that's the perfect way to end our conversation. My thanks to all three of you. Audra Wolf, thank you so much for joining us today in Radio Times, writing a book on the history of science diplomacy. Also with us, Vaughn Tarikian, Chief International Officer at the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thank you for joining us as well. And down at the NPR studios in Washington, D.C., Rush Holt, Chief Executive Officer for the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thanks to all three of you for joining
us
today on Radio Times, and you're very welcome. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes. You can find out much more about the program, including how to download a podcast of the show. Find us on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter. Listen to us on satellite radio. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoane. Thank you so much for joining us.